This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. We're talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and our guest is Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled, now in its 18th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet on the opera grounds. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
We are talking today about the opera Capriccio by Richard Strauss, and this was his last opera that premiered in 1942, and in some ways it's a little bit more abstract than some of the other operas that we've been talking about.
Yes, it really is. There's no sort of clear storyline with a beginning, middle, and end. It's a sort of about an idea. It's also Strauss at the very end of his, not well, the end of his opera career. He composed 15 operas. This is the 15th. Though I don't know if he realized this would be the last opera composition, but it was. And it was at this stage in his career, he, of course, was very well respected and regarded and not at the mercy of theater managements and impresarios as to what he could and couldn't do. That's always a limiting factor when you work. I mean, today still, of course, you know, the composer has to work with opera house managements, and it's a very collaborative event, but it can be a difficult one. In this case, Strauss decided that that he was going to do his own thing, please himself, and write a little piece about a thesis he had sort of worried and thought about all of his musical career. That is, what is more important in opera, the words or the music? And that's what the opera's about. It's as simple as that.
I'm sorry. It seems so odd to me. I mean, it's sort of like saying, what's more important in a book, the pages or the ink?
No, I think it's a little more serious than that, because given the history of opera, when opera started in the 1600s, it was really about the words. It was about poetry, and music was very much the second-class citizen in that music was only there to provide the occasional chord and give a little sense of something, continuity musically through the piece. Over the years, as opera, the emphasis changed, some sometimes preferred more music. You go to someone like the bel canto operas of Rossini and Donizetti, Bellini, and they're all about glorious singing. I mean, who cares about the music? In many cases, the poetry is can hardly be called poetry. Some libretti are pretty sorry pieces of literature. But Mozart, I think, said it best. He said in his time that poetry is the obedient daughter of the music. And the purpose of the poetry, the libretto, the storyline, the little book, is that it provides inspiration to the composer to compose music. So I think when you put it in that context, and then as you, in my book Opera Unveiled, I talk a little bit about this sort of change, the pendulum that swings from the words are more important to know the music is more important. And I think even today, you know, the composers still struggle with that. We, in a sense, don't have too much of a problem, or have not had in the past, because most operas are not in English. So we can't understand them as they happen, apart from the supertitles, the titles that will explain it. But as it's sung, we can't follow the word for word because we don't speak that language. So in a way, that says already that music is more important. But people will argue this, I mean, vehemently. There are academicians and musicologists who are still fighting it out, which is more important. Perhaps the one opera with the true poetry is Pelléas and Mélisande, that's taken from Maeterlinck's poem word for word. Even Salome, the opera Salome that Strauss wrote, he took Oscar Wilde's play and literally used word for word Wilde's images. He loved his images, and they went straight into the libretto. But that's what this is about, and it seems a little self-serving, perhaps, but the way in which this was approached, I think, was really rather beautiful. And the idea came from Strauss himself. He said, well, how do we get this abstract concept about the aesthetics of music into a stage production. He was a real man of theater. He understood what worked on stage. So he came up with the idea of a countess in her 18th century French chateau. She would be the personification of music. And she has two suitors, Flamand, who is a musician, and Olivier, who is a poet. And both of these young men are suitors for her hand. It works beautifully. I mean, that's what it's about. Who is she going to choose? Is she going to choose words or music? So that's the whole thesis of the opera from beginning to end. Strauss even called this a Conversationsstück, a conversation piece. So it's a conversation that runs from the middle of the afternoon through early evening, and then it's all over. And we are left to make up our own minds or not. And does it matter? You know, really, as the point you make, there must be words. You couldn't have opera without words, right?
Yeah.
And yet, you know, in some of the most extraordinary moments of opera, you get both ends of the spectrum. In some cases, the music stops completely and the singers sing the lines alone, and all you have is the musical voice. Other sections, Wagner, for instance. Wagner ends most of his operas with music, with no words and no singers at all. The end of Götterdämmerung, the Great Ring, ends in music. Those incredible overtures are music only. So the music, from my point of view, and I always preach this, is the music is what reaches you viscerally on those unspoken metaphysical levels, if you like, that you get the music, and the music will tell the story. The words will help you, and that's why supertitles are great, because they keep you in touch with the line of the plot. But it's really about the music, and that's what you need to be open to. And I'm going to play some lovely sections today from Capriccio that hopefully will demonstrate that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's telling that a lot of people go to opera and have gone to opera even before the supertitles were available,
right,
really to kind of listen to a concert, essentially, or to see a theatrical musical,
right,
offering.
Right. Yeah, they go for the whole experience, Gesamtkunstwerke, whole theater experience, because it is an experience on so many levels. It's spectacle, it's music, it's sets, it's costumes, it's lighting. It's even the audience, because, and I think you'll agree, Mary Charlotte, all theater is a relationship between what's going on stage and what's going on with the audience. There was a story by Camus written many, many years ago about an audience that go to an opera performance at a time of the plague in the city. And the plague is rampant, but people keep going to the opera, and they know that they are going to be exposed to other people. So they're seeing the tragedy on stage, and they dress as extravagantly as the characters in the opera, and they begin dropping in their tracks as they are dying of plague. And it sort of, it shows it makes that connect, which I think we all have with any performance. And the first thing we say is when we come out of a show of any kind, a movie, an opera, a concert, play, yeah, I loved it, I hated it. What did it mean? How did you feel? Was it worth the effort? You know, and sometimes with opera, it can be life-changing. It can be really, I mean, almost a spiritual experience. Other times, it doesn't always work. You know, the things are not in place, the music is a little off, the sets you hate, the concept you might hate, whatever it is. But when it all works, it's pure magic. And at our house here, the theater, the theater is so fantastic. You're already halfway there. So I think this would be a lovely piece. We should talk about it, perhaps.
Well, should we listen to some music, or do you want to introduce the story a little more?
Well, it's such as the story is. It starts in this lovely chateau. The countess is sitting listening to a string sextet, six musicians. She's invited into her drawing room to play for her. And they play this lovely piece of chamber music. And you'll hear a dialogue through this. This is Flamand and Olivier. The two of them are arguing a bit. Is it more about the words or the music? And then each one discovers that they also seek the countess's hand. She's a young widow. They both wanted to be the love in her life. So let's hear that first section. It'll put you into the sort of the mindset. The pacing, too. This is Richard Strauss, probably at his most beautiful in terms of music, because now he really understands the art form, the music, and it expresses what he wants to say. Let's hear a little of the opening of Capriccio.
Es entscheiden. Musik
prima le parole, dopo la musica.
Prima la musica, dopo le parole.
Vater
verglas. So this is a calm piece. There's no violent action. In fact, Richard Strauss made it very clear what he wanted in this opera when he wrote to the librettist. He said, action and character, no thoughts, no poetry, no lyricism, dry wit, intelligent dialogue, a theatrical fugue. No weighing of motifs, no poetic self-indulgences. So you wonder what's left. I mean, that describes opera pretty well. What's left is pure, distilled Strauss. This is an opera that musicologists all love with a passion because they get that, the refinement within the music. But there is a calmness to it. There's no big dramas, no crises, and a few funny moments, which is nice, which is light relief when one needs that. So they have, they've listened to this little sextet. She loves it. She's in this sort of dream, in love with the music. And her brother says, well, I'm not really interested in opera. I much prefer theatre. Her brother is the Count. We also meet the director, La Roche, who slept through the entire sextet. It's not about me, and without it doesn't do anything for me, and that without me, the director, none of this would happen. Anyway, your notes would just be writings on paper, and the play, the text would be nothing. You need the director. So that's the sort of the tension that's set up in this first piece. Now, in this next piece I'd like to play, it's a little bit about where the Olivier, the poet, is telling the Countess that he loves her. And again, he's talking about, they talk about this at length, all through this first second of the music. So again, but listen to the music, listen to the beauty of the way it's orchestrated in this section.
Meine Prosa verstummt. Ihr wisst, dass ich glühe.
Say, in a way, this opera, just from the excerpts we've listened to so far, is answering its own question, because I really have no idea what's going on, but the music sounds great.
Yes, that's enough. If you come out feeling I've had this wonderful experience with the music, how important is the story? Now, if you're talking about Romeo and Juliet, yes, you need to know the story.
Right.
And you're coming out with a very different experience. And maybe that's one of opera's strengths, that you can have these many experiences. There are many operas today that are, I think, pure meditation. Messiaen wrote a piece about St. Francis of Assisi. That's a meditative piece. We did L'Amour de Loin here about the courtly love of a knight for his lady from Love from Afar. That was pure meditation. Tea, A Mirror of Soul. There's many of them. Some are pure comedy. You come out with belly laughs. I mean, you get ridiculous comedy. You get subtle comedy. Tragedy. So it's one of its strengths, and I think that's one of the nice things about this season, every season here, actually, that there is that balance, that you can have tragedy and comedy, new opera. We need to be exposed to new opera, and audiences are now up for this. I mean, 25 years ago, you couldn't drag people to a new opera. It would be atonal and dissonant, and they'd hate it. Now they're flocking. These are the operas that do so well. So,
do they really?
Yeah, they really do. I mean, look at Cold Mountain last year, sold out well before the opening night.
Which I'm just going to go ahead and guess was because it was about Cold Mountain, which was so fantastic.
That's
not
right.
Because people are flocking to atonality.
Well, now atonality is a thing of the past, and they're getting that too. They understand new operas are not atonal.
Right.
There's something in between, perhaps, from something that's pure melody, like Romeo and Juliet of Gounod, and maybe even this. And I think with Cold Mountain too, people had read the book or seen the movie, so they were curious, and they were open to seeing it done in the genre of opera. So in this one, then, they are having this afternoon session. They're going to have a rehearsal of a play in the house, and a famous actress arrives, Clairon. Clairon was a great French tragedian of that period, and she arrives and she reads the sonnet that Olivier has written. The sonnet is a straight sonnet. Naught else there is that flames so in my heart. No, lady, naught there is on the earth's whole face. Naught else that I could sigh for as you came Venus down herself to grant my will. So it's not the world's greatest poetry. It's a sonnet.
But are we going to hear it in German?
Yes, we hear this in German, of course. Yeah, Strauss is German. This is always sung in German.
So this is a translation.
Yeah, yeah. When you get a CD of these operas, they should always come with the libretto in the language in which it's sung, German, with the English translation.
Is sonnet a form, excuse my deep ignorance,
of
something
of
that
poetry.
I should know, that is used in German language?
I think it's just a form of poetry across the board. Shakespeare.
So there's Russian sonnets
known.
And...
I don't know if Pushkin wrote in sonnets. Probably not. But
Italian sonnets?
Yes, but the Europeans certainly did. And
yeah.
Shakespeare's sonnets, of course, are probably the most famous of all. It's a 14-line stanza with final lines at the end, which this one is too. So he recites his sonnet, and then they have a little trio at the end of it in which the countess raises the question again. She says, these are the words in English from this next section I'll play you. The poet's words, how bright they shine. But what did he not dream the other perfected? Where lies the source? Did the words imply the melody? Was it already expectantly waiting, lovingly to embrace the words? Is language the womb of song, or does it come to life to be carried by her? Each lives in the other and seeks the other. Music awakens feelings which crave words. In words lies a longing for sound and music. I think we can all agree with that. You know, there are some lines you hear that you would love to hear set to music, and some beautiful music that would be great if they had some words to them. So that's valid. Olivier, however, is not happy because Flamand decides, well, I like this little sonnet. I'm going to set it to music. Olivier is furious. He says, I knew it. He's wrecking my verse. The beautiful symmetry is lost, rhyme destroyed, sentences dismembered. He's not happy about this. So let's hear, we may not get to the trio, but let's hear the sonnet that goes into the trio between the three of them then as they discuss why words or music may or may not be more important.
So wie ich hier und kenne.
And these are selections from Capriccio by Richard Strauss, which the Santa Fe Opera is going to present this summer, which I hope you will come and see, Mary Charlotte.
So what is the feel or the look of the opera? What do we know about the production so far?
Yeah, that's interesting. Did they set it in its original setting of an 18th century French drawing room just before the French Revolution? I think that is important, that this they can afford the luxury, if you like, of sitting around drinking chocolate in the afternoon, discussing at length about whether the words of music are more important than opera. So our director in this production has decided, Tim Aubrey, the great director from London, that he has moved it a little bit. And he's done something rather interesting with the set. He's taken a replica of this 18th century drawing room with its little harpsichord and its chairs, very ornate, and it seemingly sort of lifted it from Paris and put it in the middle of the stage. But it's surrounded by a very contemporary, modern, Meers van der Rohe-type house with tall white walls and lots of open spaces and mirrors. Mirrors do seem to be playing a prominent role in our operas this summer with this and of course, Vanessa as well. So there's a lovely, I think, a sort of an echoing argument here, the difference between words and music and different styles of architecture between new and old. This set is going to be lovely, just to see this set, to see this little period piece set in the middle of a very contemporary, very beautiful, very clear, clean-cut set of a contemporary house. So they are having this discussion. They go to have a rehearsal of their play with Clairon, the actress, and the director then brings with him a little entertainment for the afternoon. He brings two singers who sing a mock Italian love duet, which is sort of a send-up of the operatic style of the day. This is Strauss having fun. And he also brings a little dancer with whom he has more than a professional relationship, it becomes quite clear.
Right.
He abducted her from a duke. And this is an excuse to play three lovely dance pieces, and she dances the three, and different people have quiet conversations around the room about various issues as she's dancing. It's all very polite. It's all very elegant, and it's all very sort of calm, in spite of the argument that's going on. Let's play another little section from this, where, again, this is a fugue, where one character will follow the other, and they each come in with their different points of view on this same subject.
Tanz und Musik stehen im Band des Rhythmus, ihm unterworfen seit ewiger Zeit.
Deiner Verse Maß ist ein weit stärkerer Zwang.
Freischaltet in ihm des Dichters Gedanke. Wer zieht da die Grenze zwischen Form und Gehalt?
In irdischer Form ein unfassbar höheres Musik. Sie erhebt sich in Sphären, in die der Gedanke nicht dringt.
Nicht in unfassbaren Klängen, in klarer Sprache forme ich meine Gedanken. Dies ist der Musik für immer verwirrt.
Mein Gedanke ist die Melodie, sie kündet Tieferes, ein Wunder.
Welten um eine Rangordnung ihrer Künste verlorene Mühe im Bereich meiner Bühne dienen sie alle
und in ihrem Mittel der Diskussion über das Streitthema unserer Tage.
Musik ist eine erhabene Kunst, nur unwillig dient sie dem Trug des Theaters.
So I should probably tell you the recording I'm using in this. It's a beautiful recording with Gundula Janowitz singing the Countess. Tatiana Troyanis is Clairon. Peter Schreier is Flamand. Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, the great singer, is the Count. Karl Böhm is conducting this DGG recording that I would encourage people to get. So then you can listen to this and follow the libretto.
So we are talking to Desiree Mays about the opera Capriccio by Richard Strauss. And this is an opera that premiered kind of in the middle of World War II.
Yeah, Richard Strauss lived through two world wars. I mean, unbelievable. From his first operas of Salome and Electra, right the way through Der Rosenkavalier. He had a long career, 15 operas, but spread over that time period. And when you think about the calmness of this piece, which he manages to compose in his home at Garmisch, where he lived high in the mountains of Bavaria, how did he keep apart from it? One musicologist wrote and said that he sort of internalized. He managed to keep the war at bay by just losing himself in this music, and he really does that because there's no sense of crisis or drama or Hitler, of World War II in this music.
And yet, which is pretty amazing,
it is. And yet this premiere was held in Munich in October 1942 when there were nightly air raids on the city. In fact, the German opera houses took a terrible beating. Munich, Dresden, Berlin, Leipzig. The opera houses were bombed by the Allies, by us during the war. I would have avoided hitting those places.
Yeah.
That's really terrible. And he was distraught about this. I mean, this is where his whole life had been, his career had been, particularly in Dresden, and those beautiful houses were destroyed. There was an interesting comment by the producer of Capriccio during October 1942 at the premiere. He said, "Who can imagine a great city like Munich in total darkness, or theatergoers picking their way through the blacked-out streets with the aid of small torches, giving off a dim blue light through a narrow slit? All of this for the experience of the Capriccio premiere. They risked being caught in a heavy air raid, and yet their yearning to hear Strauss's music, their desire to be part of a festive occasion and to experience a world of beauty beyond the dangers of war led them to overcome all these material problems." That's marvelous. I mean, that's the spirit of the German people. They love their music and they loved Richard Strauss, that they went out and risked death to go to these performances. The opera did very well. We premiered it here. The Santa Fe Opera presented the American premiere of Capriccio in August of 1958. And that was conducted by John Crosby, the founder of the Santa Fe Opera, of course, who loved Strauss and presented many of these operas. So, this was a difficult time for everyone. In fact, at the end of the war, his house was commandeered and he was ordered out of the house and the country. In fact, the American soldiers who came to requisition the house, you know, normally they burst in and take over, as happens at the end of a war. And the young soldier who came to Strauss's house recognized the old man as Strauss. And,
he
was so polite. He said, I can't do anything. I have to ask you to leave. But it was under those circumstances. A few years later, he and his wife were allowed back to Garmisch, where they had spent most of their lives and loved it with a passion. And he celebrated his 85th year there after the war was over and died the following year. But this Capriccio was the last opera. He wrote more wonderful music afterwards, of course, but Capriccio was the last. His statement, his last words on the subject of opera. So,
wow. It's really amazing to contemplate an opera literate soldier
In that moment, it must have been amazing. It's reported in all the books. What an incredible moment. And a man who had been so deeply respected and who was so upset by this war. He had stayed in Germany and is still criticized for that. He stayed under the Hitler regime. But he said that he stayed in order to do what he could to protect music from the horrors that was going on. The arts, culture, music was being destroyed. Most of the Jewish, all of the Jewish conductors, of course, had to leave. In fact, the early librettist on this, Stefan Zweig, had to be taken off because he was Jewish at the time. So all of that is sort of in the background of this. But to get back to our little conversation piece here.
Yes.
So all these characters are meeting together, and then they decide they know it's the Countess's birthday. What are they going to do to celebrate? So they decide they're going to put on an opera, which is a great idea. But what topic will they use? So there's a lot of little in-jokes here where they suggest Ariadne auf Naxos, Der Liebe der Danae, operas that Strauss has already written. So obviously they can't do any of those. And it is the Count, the Countess's brother, who says, "Why don't you write a little opera about our conversation of this afternoon, which is more important, words and music," which is a very nice way of segueing into the whole thing. So this is what they all rush off to do. Meantime, both Flamand and Olivier have been trying to convince the Countess that she must choose. Who will she choose? And she tells both of them that she will meet them at 11 o'clock in the library the following morning. the director plans a great theatrical extravaganza. And there's a wonderful fun piece in the midst of this here, what they call the laughing octet, where the director says, "Without me, you're nothing. All I am about is artistic integrity," and they're laughing at him. You'll hear that. This is followed then by a very angry octet. It's one of the more interesting musical sections of the opera. So let's hear a little of the laughing octet, where Flamand and Olivier both laugh at the director. So we're talking about Capriccio of Richard Strauss at the Santa Fe Opera. People can call the theater and get tickets sooner rather than later because these performances do sell out.
Yeah, and it's, kudos to the Santa Fe Opera for doing so well year after year after year. It's the 60th anniversary this year.
It is, yes. And they've invited many of the, I think they invited as many as they could find of past artists and production people to come back to the opera in the last week of August, the final week of the season. It's called Come Home. And there'll be a lot of wonderful celebrations and events and the famous singers who will come and hopefully get involved with some artistic events that people will will have to watch the newspaper to learn about, because that's all still being set up. But, yeah, 60 years since John Crosby started with this small 200-seat theater that was wide open to the elements in the beginning.
There was no roof at first?
Virtually none. I mean, it was wide open. And then there was the terrible fire, of course. A few years in, there was a fire and virtually destroyed the theater. They were playing Carmen. Everyone had gone home late after the show, and somehow a fire started in the middle of the night, and by the time they got to it, there was no water up there at the time. It was really tough putting that fire out, so they lost a lot. And by a miracle, Olean Opera, they managed to pull together as much as they could. And the Sweeney Auditorium became the opera house because a couple of days after this great fire, they put Carmen on in the Sweeney Auditorium.
Amazing.
It was incredible.
The old basketball court.
That's right. That's right. And now it has built. The theater is now over 2,000 seats. It's virtually enclosed, though, you know, you'd spoil the integrity of an outdoor theater if you completely closed it in, and that's not been done. So the sides are still open, and that wind can come through in the evenings. It can be cool. And upstage can be open, and it's up to the directors to choose whether they want to have the very back of the stage open to the night sky, where you can see at the beginning of the performances the sunset. I mean, it's extraordinary.
It's amazing.
It is amazing.
You can get out your little cell phone and try to take a picture, and one of the very polite ushers will tell you not to.
As forbidden it is, yes. And then it gets dark and night comes and you get the magic. The lighting comes in then. That was always one of the challenges. They felt, well, we have to start at 9 o'clock so that it's nighttime for the lighting. But in fact, the theater now presents the operas at 8:30 in July and 8 o'clock in August. And they do tend to start just as the sun is setting and you go through that wonderful sunset to night. I'll never forget with Salome, a dress rehearsal of Strauss's Salome some years ago, the last scene is under the moon. The moon is so shocked at the horror of what's happening when Johanna is beheaded that she veils her face and a cloud passes over the moon. And in the dress rehearsal, center stage was this brilliant moon. And as the singer sang those very last bars, a cloud moved across the moon and it happened just as in the libretto.
Oh, my goodness.
The director was really upset. He said, how can we keep that in for every performance? The moon will not stay in place. So.
Talk to God.
Yeah, there's things like that that happen here. They can happen in no other theater on earth unless they have that sort of, nothing like ours. The setting is so beautiful. So we should quickly end up, I suppose, the story. There is no real resolution. Musically, however, something wonderful happens. Strauss takes the little string quartet that opens the piece, and there's sort of a great arc through to the final aria, which is the aria of the Countess, where she comes alone on stage in a beautiful evening gown. She's going to dine alone, and she goes to the mirror and she says, well, Madeleine, who should you choose, Il Flamand or Olivier, the music or the words? And she comes to the conclusion that she cannot choose, that the two need one another. They're inextricably bound. And she laughs a little when she thinks, well, both men are going to the library at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. They won't find me. They'll find one another. And that, of course, is the bottom line. They are inextricably, she will not choose one or the other. So
then who will she choose eventually?
Yeah, not these two. Somebody else.
Right.
Another director. Who knows?
A circus performer.
Yes, who knows? So let's play a little of the final sections of the opera. I think Strauss himself answers the piece because she finishes as this long, beautiful aria, and then the majordomo comes in and he says, Madame, supper is served, a totally trivial line. And that's the words part. And then Strauss follows it up with a truly exquisite, lyrical little phrase of music that does end the opera. It's as if he's saying, it is, of course, music that is the answer to the riddle. So let's hear those last moments.
Thank you.
final moments of Capriccio by Richard Strauss. And, you know, it's maybe not, as you said, the plot that's going to
get you in this one. No way.
That's going to get you, but it will be, in fact, the music and just the kind of atmosphere of it.
And the beautiful staging. This yeah. needs to be beautifully staged. Otherwise, it can just be boring. But directors are doing such a good job now with even in a long aria where someone is only singing two or three lines, there's enough happening that you know what the character is thinking. It can hold your attention. So, this is a beautiful piece.
So let's talk about some of the other things that go on at the opera. I mean, the opera is not just as we always talk about the experience of going and seeing the spectacle of the opera from your seat, but it's what you do before and the other things going on around it. Like, you can take backstage tours.
Yes, the backstage tours are a great way of getting closer to the action, as it were. You just show up at the box office Monday through Friday at 9 o'clock, and the backstage tours start at May 30th, and they run through August 26th. Again, you just show up at the box office. The docents are marvelous. They go through an extended training in order to do this. And since the house has undergone so much renovation and development, it's quite extraordinary what they've done up there. So even for locals who think they know the Santa Fe Opera, do this. Or take your guests, your out-of-town guests, and you can give them a real treat. If there's no rehearsal on stage, you may actually get on stage, which is always thrilling. To get that perspective, standing there looking out at that 2,000-plus seat house is really quite wonderful. You can talk and your voice will be heard at the back. So things like that are always thrilling.
Which is incredible to contemplate, because that's how the best opera houses, that's how opera houses were built before microphones were invented, which is you have to have, even for somebody with an incredible voice that projects beautifully, you have to have superb acoustics if the person in the back is going to hear you.
Yeah, when that house was renovated, acoustics was the number one issue of importance. The acoustics had to be great, and they are. When the back was open before, the singers said that they would sing a note and their voice would go out the back and keep going, but now that the back is closed in, the voice will go out and sort of turn around and come back, and they can get a sense of where they are. It's a musical thing, but they say it's much better for them because they have a much better sense of the sound that they're working in. And they'll demonstrate that. They'll take you to the costume shop. That's riveting, watching how the costumes are made, the fabrics, the detail. This house prides itself on beautiful costumes that are made as close to the originals as possible. There are no zips on 18th century costumes. They all have little hooks and eyes or lacings at the back. They're also built with very wide hems and extra sections of fabric, because we rent out our productions. If somebody falls in love, another opera house with La Boheme, that production, the sets, lighting designs and costumes will go to another opera house. But no two singers are created alike. Some now these days are very skinny, 130 pounds.
Yeah, the Natalie Dessay type.
That's right, but her costume's not going to fit a 200-pound singer. So the costumes are built with extra hems for different heights and with extra fabric around the middle to let it in. I mean, amazing the way these things are done. So that's something that's really fun to do. It's a nominal charge, and that is something if you want to do on your go up anytime, anyone can go. That's fun.
I would also like to say, bring the kids.
Yes, do bring the kids. Also bring sunscreen and a hat. It's hot. They're also offering what they call Opera Insider Days, and this is where the guild members welcome guests at 8:15 on Saturdays. These Saturdays run from June the 4th until August the 27th. 8:15, actually it's early, but it's a good time. It's not too hot yet, right? There's a light breakfast, and then at 8:45 there will be someone from the opera's production, maybe one of the singers, who we'll talk a little bit about that production, and then there's a complimentary backstage tour that goes with that as well. So you can call the box office about all these various things. The opera shop has been completely transformed. It's a beautiful shop now. It will be open from June 1st, and it's open before, during, and after performances. So go in and look through the items there. There's a lot of opera stuff and a lot of other stuff. So,
and for those of you who... And not that I expect anybody, including myself, to do so. But for those of you who think this far in advance, great Christmas gifts for opera lovers.
Yes, that's right. And you're helping support the opera. All of these projects help support the art form, which is a phenomenally expensive one to put on. Roughly, whatever you pay for your seat, whether it's $30 or $300, that really only represents about 50% of the true cost of what it is to put on an opera.
Yeah.
It is a luxury, but opera is pretty well thriving, you know, across the country this day. It's really thrilling that that's happening. There's a big orchestra to support. I mean, all the singers, the production people, hundreds. In fact, the Santa Fe Opera is the biggest employer in the state of New Mexico after the government in the summer months. And the sort of the spillover, it works so well for us. And people are staying in hotels, they're eating in restaurants, they're buying art, they go to Indian Market. I must say, when I talk at the preview buffet during Indian Market weekend, it's amazing. Everyone's there covered in turquoise and all the wonderful goodies that they have brought. And many, many people from Indian tribes come in from all over the country. That's really exciting.
Economic development at work.
Absolutely.
Desiree Mays, thank you so much for being with us today on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654. The local number in Santa Fe is 505-986-5900. Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.